Starting a new series about the Jewish home tonight, and this is the one class that usually guys attend the most, and I like the least, for the simple reason that I feel like someone with a long white beard should be giving the class and not me. So my disclaimer at the beginning of class is I'm going to say things and try to explain them, and I recommend to you to get other reading material and check out the thoughts that are presented. And increase your knowledge. This is just the starting point. This is one man's perspective. Take what makes sense for you. Leave what does not. And I hope that we do not err and that we succeed. This class is the product of phone calls from girls that dated guys from Machon Meir. And the girls said, the guys need a class about the Jewish home because they're learning theory all week long. And then when we discuss practice of a Jewish home, they don't have a picture. So what I have said before, and I will keep saying throughout the class, is the greatest asset you can attain, the greatest source of knowledge you can have about the Jewish home is from visiting other homes. I grew up, Baruch Hashem, in a frum home, and I went around seeing other homes, and from each home I was in, I learned a lot. Some homes you learn more about what yes to do. In other homes, you learn more about what not to do. But you can always learn. It's worth going and learning. Rav Listman, Rav Orna Levi, Zacharia Reich, and myself, and I put myself at the end of the list simply because I'm not here that much. When I'm here, I'm learning with you guys. But they're your first options. Will help you get set up with families. If the first three options aren't working, come to me. I'll do the best I can. But get set up. You guys should have families that you're comfortable with, that you like going to. Not only rabbis here. There are many families in the neighborhood. And go out. Go see. And try to learn and try to understand. A few points. If you're a guest in someone's house, so try to adopt whatever is common courtesy. They will not do to you what Ben Franklin did to his guests. You know the story with Ben Franklin. He saw his guests had no clue about how to be in the White House. Whatever he did, they did. So at one point during the meal, he took the milk and poured it into the saucer. So all the guests took the milk and poured it into the saucer. Then he took it and put it down for the dog, and they didn't know what to do. Your hosts won't do that. What everyone else is doing, you guys can do. If everyone else is washing, go wash. If everyone's staying in this room, don't go exploring the rest of the house. Stay in that room. If they're standing for Kiddush, you stand. Don't go against the flow, go with the flow. If they don't have hot pepper at the table, so you'll have one meal without hot pepper. People sometimes, I get phone calls from hosts that the guests insulted them. Do you have hot pepper? Oh, you don't have harif, you don't have this, you don't have that. It's not fair. The host is happy to have you. It should be a good guest as well. Appreciate what they have. And you're not there for the food. You might be there for the food, but let's make believe you're not there for the food. Do what I did when I was a bachelor. Buy yourselves pizza, buy yourselves a rogalach or whatever it is, and you'll eat when you get back to the Machon. But I'm serious. I'm not joking. I remember I went to a family's house, and they were very, very nice. And then at some point in the meal, they bring this little like cereal bowl with salad, and they put it in front of me. So I'm sitting there wondering, what is this? There are 15 people seated around the table, and I put a little bowl with salad by me. So I'm thinking, okay, I don't know what they mean, so I'm going to pass it on. So I pass it on, and they say, no, take some before you pass it on. I realized then that it was this bowl for the whole table. So I understood why everyone was skinny around the table. But it's no joke. Imagine if I would have sat down and just put that on my plate. I didn't know. You're coming here. The norms here are different, as you will see. Go out and see as much as you can. At the same time, go with the flow. We have to abide by the host's rules, not them by our rules. Okay, enough said. Now, to the point of this class, the Jewish home. The thing that has been the envy of the world since the inception of the Jewish people has been the Jewish home. You can just read history and read what the nations have said about it and what the nations have tried to do to the Jewish home, going back into the Greek, to the Hellenistic period, going back to the Second Temple, going back to Pharaoh. And you will see generation after generation had great envy of the Jewish home. I don't think I'm smart enough to tell you all the secrets of a good Jewish home. But we will try to familiarize ourselves with concepts that are integral to Jewish philosophy and to the building of a Jewish home, and you're going to see that there's a great chasm between the ethics and the traits that we aspire to build within our home and the goals of a home that the Western world tries to build. A world of a difference. And I want to begin by sharing with you a thought and a story. There was a young couple that were not planning on leading a religious lifestyle. But the parents of one of the spouses had chosen to lead a religious lifestyle, and they had religious friends. So they asked the couple, they said, we're going to bring our friends to this wedding. Do us a favor. Let's have, in the beginning of the wedding, 20 minutes of dances separate. Men on one side, women on the other side, and traditional Jewish dancing for 20 minutes, so that we could have our friends and they'll feel comfortable. The couple argued, the couple protested, the couple said, why are you so old-fashioned? Why can't your friends just get with the times? And eventually the couple acquiesced. The couple said, if your friends won't come, if you won't enjoy the wedding, for 20 minutes we'll do it the way you want. The next morning I get an email. The couple says their nicest part of the wedding were those 20 minutes. And I read that email and I asked myself, why? I couldn't understand it. I read the email. They had no reason to lie to me. They had spent the whole time before the wedding prefacing, oh no, we're going to have to do it old fashioned, what are our friends going to say? I couldn't figure out why, because all the weddings I go to, that's a given, that's the way the dancing goes. Let's pause for 1 second. If you speak to someone who has children and they're trying to educate them, people will very often say, in today's Western world, my goal is that a child fulfills his potential. Every person in life has to fulfill their potential. I had a friend who was a genius. I mean, he's a little older than me, but brilliant guy. I don't know if he had a photographic memory. I don't know exactly what, but brilliant. And he'd read in the Torah every Shabbos. He had no problem because he knew the whole Torah by heart, you know, the tunes, everything. And then, at one point, he decided that he's leaving everything, and went and became a pop star. So he took his talents, his musical talents, and he started playing the guitar. And at one point, he wrote back, and he said, there's such a difference between playing a guitar before an audience and praying or reading the Torah before an audience. So I said, I would hope there'd be a difference between reading the Torah and playing a guitar before an audience. He said, yeah, yeah, but there's a very subtle difference, aside from the content. When you play the guitar before the audience, you're standing, facing them, showing off your talent, and everyone's applauding you. It's all about me. Look at what I'm doing. Look at how good I am. When you're standing in prayer, or you're standing as reading the Torah on behalf of the congregation, your back is to them. You're all facing the ark. We're all part of the same service. We're all facing God. So it's not a question of look at how good I read the Torah. It's a question of we're all trying to do a service. This is my role within the service, and we're all facing there. We're not facing the congregation. What happens when you go to a wedding? What happens when you go to a dance hall? What happens when people are dancing what's called the modern Western dances? What's everyone trying to do? Show how they know the moves, dance with someone of the opposite gender, and enjoy themselves. I'm enjoying me, I'm enjoying her, I'm enjoying us. That's a dance in a non-religious wedding. What's a dance in a religious wedding? We dance with all the men together, but what's the focus? The focus is to make the chatan happy, to rejoice with him. He's at the center of the dance. That's why this couple wrote back that those 20 minutes were their favorite 20 minutes. For those 20 minutes, the congregation was with them. What happened when they took down the mechitzas and they started doing the other dancing? Everyone was enjoying themselves. But no one was with the chatan or kala. Oh yeah, there were all kinds of guys trying to dance with the kala. Maybe the chatan was dancing with all kinds of girls. But the chatan and kala, as far as them, and them being with their friends, and their friends having their sole goal, were dancing in a circle with you, that wasn't there anymore. It was a totally different dance.
Now that just shows us an example of a subtle difference, something which I didn't even catch till I got this email. A subtle difference. They had a march here. You guys might have heard about it. They called it the March of Pride. You guys heard about it?
Yeah.
By us, the word pride is a word we're ashamed of. We're not looking to be proud. Proud is something that we say, a Jew is not supposed to be proud. A Jew doesn't have to feel bad about being Jewish. A Jew can be proud of the Jewish people. But there's no such thing as I am proud. Yes, if I'm proud, I will work on myself and I'll be a humble person. My goal isn't to be proud. I didn't understand how these people could walk around and speak about pride. What? Pride by us is a trait to be overcome. It's one of the traits that brings a person down. When we speak about the Jewish home, we speak about concepts such as tzniut. What does tzniut mean? What's the root of the word tzniut?
Hidden.
Hidden. We take something beautiful and we're matzniah it. We hide it. We don't have to show it off to the whole world. We don't flaunt our relationships. Quite the contrary. We cherish them. When you cherish something, keep it in private. We speak about ne'emanut. We're going to discuss the extent of our ne'emanut from the word emet, how much faith one could and should have within a relationship. We're going to discuss a concept of holiness, the Shechina. We're going to discuss what ahava means. What does ahava mean? Does ahava really mean love? We'll have a whole class. Usually we have two or three classes on what does ahava really mean? And we're going to discuss kedusha. What does it mean to have holiness within the Jewish home? We had a class on dating, and we will, B'ezrat Hashem, have more classes on dating. These classes are not to be confused with the dating classes. When you date, there's a whole different set of rules, what you look for, how you build, how you search, how you build a relationship. That's one stage in life. But that stage ends, and then for the rest of our lives, we're building this home, which will affect our children, which will affect ourselves, and the more we prepare for it, hopefully, the better prepared we'll be when the time comes. And that's the purpose of this class. So just don't confuse it with dating. Dating is a whole different set of rules. We're not talking about dating. We're talking about starting with after we've gotten engaged. Hopefully. When you ask a person, what's it like to be single? Person that's not married. So a person will say, it's like a car with half a tank. The Talmud says it's not that way. The Talmud says it's like a car without the motor. It's not that you could drive half as far. It's that you can't do what a whole car does. The Talmud says, and we will discuss that section of the Talmud, Hashavui b'lo isha, when a person is without a wife, he cannot attain the Torah the way he should. He cannot attain happiness the way he should. He cannot attain balance in his life the way he should. All of life is affected by that. Marriage is something that encompasses all of life and gives balance and happiness and success. And success isn't measured by monetary success, obviously, in all aspects of life. The Torah describes to us that when God created man male and female, meaning the couple together are what we call Adam. You want to know what's a complete Adam? A complete Adam is a married person. A person when he's single is called, in Kabbalah terms, plag guf, a half a body. He's half. It's not that he's a car with half a tank, it's that he's half a car. He's got half the motor. Yeah?
So what happens if a person's spouse dies? Do they go back to being half a person?
For sure. For sure. And we will have to discuss ahava on a different level. We have a class online which is very fitting for this time. Rav Moshe Cordoviro was a renowned Kabbalist. He wrote a work called Tomer Devorah, The Palm Tree of Devorah. And that work, the later parts of the work have more Kabbalah. The first parts discuss God's 13 attributes. The 13 attributes of kindness, God's 13 attributes. We're going to say them now. Slichot, right? Hashem, Hashem, Kel, Rahum, Mechanun. And he goes through each one and describes how we're supposed to emulate God in those traits. So 2 or 3 years ago, on Fridays, we'd learn that for 10 minutes.
So you have it online. If you want, it's worth going through this time of year. We're going to discuss those attributes of God, how we can learn from them. One of the attributes that he discusses is love. How can I love my fellow man? Where does that concept come from? And how does that work? Can I really love someone like I love myself? Most people have a very hard time doing that, especially in marriage, where you'd expect it. We live in a day and age where people have a hard time doing it towards their kids, where it should be natural. And I want us to begin, what we started doing last semester, as per Guy's request, was we started doing practical exercises. Guy said that's not enough to learn the theory, we have to do some practical exercises. So I assume that guys would want that this year as well. Yeah? But then don't complain, you know, there's a certain amount of faith, trust, that grows as we learn together. This is our first class together. And the practice exercise I want to do today, you're going to feel like dunces. But it's a worthwhile exercise. We should really start the exercise now. We don't have that much time left. We have 10 minutes left. I need 4 guinea pigs. But they're going to sit up here with me. Come. Okay. We got 4, you can join. Okay, so we need 2 on this side and 2 on this side. Guys, bring your chairs. No, sit down. For the rest of the class, you're going to sit? Oh, I'm so mad.
Geniuses who are prophets.
Bring your chairs, guys. I'm sorry, I apologize in advance, and you can back out. The second you hear what you got to do, you can back out.
I don't know what it is.
Okay. When I was about to give my first class, here, I need 2 on this side, 2 on that side, 3 on this side, whatever. When we were about to start the first class on the Jewish home, so a friend of mine came by and saw me preparing the notes. So he said to me, what are you preparing notes for? I said, I'm supposed to give a class tonight on the Jewish home. These guys are going to get married, build a home. He says to me, well, all you got to tell them is work on being good people and you'll be good spouses. What do you need to tell them? So I said, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. He's right. He's got a point. And one of the points that we have a hard time when we work on being good people is that we feel like we don't always have control. So we have a concept when it comes to working on being good people that the external affects the internal. Meaning it's not always what I feel inside is what's expressed outside. Sometimes I could work the other way around. If I'm about to yell, I was just yelled at, I'm about to yell back, I could stop, lower my voice, say, give me just a second. And just the mere fact that I've lowered my voice, ma'anerach, Shlomo Mel says, Dani, it brings back, Meshiv Chema, it brings back anger. Ma'anerach, when you give a soft response, it automatically calms down the situation. So sometimes we have to learn the devices that will help us practically. What's the external that will affect the internal? And now, because I feel bad that you guys will feel like dunces if I don't tell you the conclusion of the experiment before we start it, so I'm going to cheat. I'm going to tell you the conclusion unless you guys protest. But I'm telling you, this experiment is so true, everyone who has done it testified that it was 100% true, that you guys, if you don't want to believe it, all you have to do is try it yourself for 5 minutes during the class. And here's the experiment. You two have to spend the next 10 minutes on the clock smiling. Just smile. Whatever you do, just smile. And you two have to spend the rest of the next 10 minutes looking angry. Not allowed to smile. You got to look at the class looking angry. Now you can back out. If you don't want to do it, don't do it.
So much better.
Now,
where... Can I just try?
So do whatever you want. Okay. Now, what's want to be angry? Come, sit up here. There was, you guys doing it? Smile, cute. Good. Like that, exactly. You guys are looking upset? No, you're not doing it. Where does this come from? The experiment, there was a book written about facial expressions. And in that book, they wanted to break down how can you tell from someone's facial expression when we're serious, when we're sad, when we're angry? Different, we move so many muscles in every expression. They sat there practicing their different expressions, seeing what they can control and what they can't control. And what they discovered in the middle of the experiment, as they were trying to decipher the different muscles they were moving to express different expressions, was that when they moved, when they stayed in a position and they were analyzing one another, when they were working on the happy expressions, they were happy. They couldn't help but be happy. And when they had the angry expressions on their face, and they were trying to work, figure out what in their face, what muscles were they moving to be angry, they were upset. It affected them. Right. Exactly. And that's what Chazal always taught us. Chazal said, you gotta smile. You gotta really smile. Hey, how did this come to me? I was once talking to one of my kids, and they said, Abba, why aren't you smiling at me? So I decided to play a game on them. This was during Shabbos meal. I put a dopey smile on my face, and I didn't take it off for 10 minutes. And imagine sitting at a Shabbos table, and your father just talks to you like this. And I said, okay, yeah, I'm smiling. Are you happy now? Good. Okay, I sat the rest of the Shabbos table like this for the next 10 minutes. And I discovered, hey, this works. After 10 minutes, I couldn't stop smiling. It affected me. I said, you know what? This experiment really works. You know, you read it in theory. Ah, you see, you guys aren't going to hold out. But try it. Guys, no, you got to leave a dopey here.
It's
this.
Like easier for me to be happy and stuff.
So do that.
I'm angry.
Okay.
Really
so leave a smile. But, so the first experiment I want us to take for this week, we'll meet again Sunday. Take 10 minutes. Where you do your utmost to smile. You don't have to put on a dopey grin. But try smiling during those 10 minutes. And see how suddenly everything that happens around you, when your roommate upsets you, your chavrus upsets you, everything that happens, you're going to feel automatically your reaction is different. It'll affect you. It won't only affect everyone else, that everyone else will feel like being different to you. It'll affect who you are and how you feel. And that's the first exercise I want us to first experiment with, because one of the hardships that people have when they approach the Torah is when the Torah tells us lo sachmo, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wealth, thy neighbor's home, thy neighbor's wife. What do you mean? I can control what I think? What's the Torah telling me? That's one of the first things that people find hard. How could the Torah tell me what to think and what not to think? And we're going to discuss a lot about how to build our own personalities and how to build what we feel and control what we feel. And this is a very, very real experiment where you'll really sense how you can affect how you feel. You can affect how you behave. I mean, you've probably seen the research about how they found that school dress codes and uniforms and wearing a button-down shirt and dress pants affects the behavior. They go to the slums, they buy everyone these clothing, and suddenly these students have a lower crime rate. Same teachers, same everything. Suddenly it affects them. It affects who we are, whether we like it or not. Hachisoniyut, the external, mashpiala pnimiyut, affects the internal. Let's remember, the key is the internal, but it affects us. So this is a simple experiment. Try it, you'll see it for yourself, and I think every person should think during this week to take 10 minutes during the day where they smile. Just smile. Walk around with a smile and see. Try to take 10 minutes, which will be challenging, like during lunchtime, you know, right? You guys know lunchtime around here, or you're new here. You guys know? Okay. Okay. So now let's begin. Wherever you look in the world, people are gauged by their accomplishments outside the home. In Judaism, we don't look beyond the home. We begin with the home. When the Chafetz Chaim was eulogized, so one of the things they mentioned was that before we gauge anyone outside the home, we don't look at a person and say he was the greatest general. We first look at what kind of person was he in the home. What kind of husband, father, son, brother, what kind of person was he to those that were closest to him? The Prophet, when he tells us about being good people, reminds us, like an adjunct, he says, "Umibisarcha al titalam," and don't ignore your own flesh. Sometimes we can be good to everyone, but when it comes to the people that are closest to us, there we sort of trample on them. And it has to be the exact opposite. We begin with those that are closest to us, and that's where we're gauged the most. The people who are the most abusive to their spouses can be the nicest people to everyone else. Because, you know, we're going to discuss about the beauty of the home, but at the same time, it is most challenging within the home to be a kind and good person. That is where it is most important, but that is where it is also most challenging. You know,
Everyone else, we meet now, he's got a beautiful smile on his face. I'm not going to see him in an hour. So even if right now I'm getting on his nerves, in an hour he's rid of me. But your spouse, when you escape everyone else, you're with them. That's where you escape to. So the home is Bezrat Hashem, the place where you want to escape to. But at the same time, when that's your escape, that's your cave, that's where you're going back home, so then if there are things that annoy, they annoy a lot. Right? Makes sense.
More tension already by knowing that?
I don't think so, no. I think every person gets married wanting to have that place to go home to. Every person gets married with a picture of his parents' home after 35 years, where they've already worked out many of their differences, and therefore they're more accepting of one another's nuances, and they think that when they're going to enter marriage, the wife's already going to accept their shtuyot like their mother accepted their father's shtuyot. Or worse, what most people expect is they walk into marriage thinking, well, my mother didn't mind if I put my socks near the table, or I left my dirty floss near the bed, or I A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Why does my wife mind? Our mothers are all accepting, and our wives suddenly have certain demands that are, like, ridiculous. What's wrong with you, she says. You ate half an apple and left the other half by the keyboard? I don't understand. Where do you think you live? You have a maid here cleaning up after you? My mother never spoke to me like that. Right? Okay. Right. Your mother didn't. Your wife will. And if you think about it, logically, she's right. But that's... We'll get to that. We're just starting. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good, yeah?
Thank you.
How are you guys doing?
Not so good.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we can stop. Release. It's okay. You guys do?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so let's begin. What does the word marriage mean? What does marriage mean? No. Okay. I didn't get Webster's dictionary definition. But let's do differently. What does the word nisu'in mean? Oh. Nisu'in comes from the word nisa, to uplift. So the reason nisu'in, which means literally the uplifting, we translate it as marriage, but the root of the word really means uplifting. You guys know that in Hebrew words have deep meaning, they're godly. Hebrew is therefore called Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue. God created this language to be the language in which he communicates with the prophets, with the world, that writes the Torah, Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language. We don't have vulgar words in Lashon HaKodesh. Lashon HaKodesh, whenever we want to discuss something that's less than clean, we use
Arabic.
We use terms that are similar. If we want to discuss, a bathroom, what's the bathroom called in Hebrew?
Sherutim.
Either the use, the place which you use, doesn't say bathroom, or Beit HaKiseh, the house with the chair. We don't have something that's directly descriptive. If we want to discuss the male organ, we call it the Aver. If we want to discuss intimate relations, we call it tashmish hamita, use of the bed. We don't have terms that are directly descriptive. We're Hebrew is modest. It's the holy tongue. So modern Hebrew has adopted all kinds of words. I mean, so they've filled in the blanks, right? But real Hebrew, real Lashon HaKodesh is holy. And so in Lashon HaKodesh, the word marriage is nisu'in. The main complaint that people have when it comes to marriage is they say, I'm putting in my 50%. She's not putting in her 50%. Come on. I do the dishes. I do the laundry. I take out the kids. I prepare the food. I do the shopping. Half the week I do the cooking. I do the cleaning. What's she doing all day? Nisu'in, according to one understanding, is called uplifting because I'm taking you on my back. I'm giving 100%. Nisu'in isn't about I do 50, you do 50. Nisu'in is about I do 100. And when we discussed our class in dating, we mentioned that dating is about real life.
Dating isn't the class in Musa. Dating isn't about what type of person you should be. Dating is about who am I and who matches me given who I am today. Dating is real. This is what's happening. I want to tell you, what we're going to discuss here tonight, and what we're going to discuss in all these classes is real. This is relevant to everyone here. I'm not talking about the fact that every one of you has potential to be one of the giants of the Jewish people. I'm talking about you where you are today. Bezrat Hashem, you'll still be the giants of the Jewish people. But you have to know that the concepts I'm discussing for the layman, for everyone. It's relevant to me, you, everyone, all of us. This is relevant to all of us. When I say marriage is about giving 100%, I mean this is for everyone. You should know there are non-Jews that listen to this class. I get emails from non-Jews about the Binyan HaBayit class. And they like following what we do here. This isn't only about being Jewish. I quote the Jewish sources. But technically, this is good advice for every marriage. This isn't only about being a pious person. No, I'm talking about how you build a good home. Any marriage, in order for any marriage to work, we have to be prepared to give, to put in. Rav Dessler has a thought in one of his works. He, in Michtav Me'eliyahu, he writes, in life we have a choice. Are we going to be a giver or a taker? At every step of the way, we have to make that decision. Am I giving or taking? What am I? And in marriage, in order for marriage to work, we have to be prepared to give. Rav Eliyahu Kitov wrote a beautiful work. We used to learn it here. It's called The Jew in His Home, Ishu Beito. And in that work, he writes an interesting formula. He says, yeah, really good book. They have it here in the library. They don't? They used to. I guess now it's in someone else's library. So... And that work he writes, no, I bought a few copies for this library, so I know they have a few. In that work he writes, he says, you know on what day happiness ends in the marriage? Happiness ends on the day when a person starts demanding. So long as he's ready to give, the marriage is a happy marriage. The day he stops and says, wait a second, now wait. What about you? What about what I'm legitimately demanding? What I legitimately want. That's the day happiness ends, and that's the day problems begin. Yes, sir?
Does that go for like the women also?
100%, but our class is to the men. We have female listeners, but our class is to the men.
Women
and men a lot. Every man thinks that his wife is unusually demanding of him. And every woman thinks that she's doing an unusual amount with almost no appreciation. The standard peeve of men is that she's nagging and demanding and unappreciating. The standard peeve of women is he's not understanding, he's not caring, and he's unappreciative. Standard. Why? Why? So a lot of it is the attitudes we have, and a lot of it is our communication. We're going to focus in our learning about what's fair to expect, what are we building, what attitudes we should have, and understanding one another. A lot of what we're going to discuss is understanding. Okay. We'll begin what's really usually our focus on the second class, but we'll begin with it today. What is enemy number one of any relationship once you're ready to get engaged? After you've gotten engaged, and once you're married?
The mother-in-law.
There are three classical problems within a marriage, and they are broken down to mother-in-law, intimacy, and money, if we want to get technical. But I'm talking about something else. The first problem that people have, and usually they coach it with religiosity, is the doubt. Maybe she's not Mrs. Right. Now that doubt begins the day you get engaged. When a guy comes to me and tells me I got engaged, I say, Mazal tov, have you had second thoughts yet? It's the first thing I tell every guy. And usually they look at me and they're not sure what to say, and then they say, no. And I say, right. Okay. So if you haven't, you will. Everyone has second thoughts. Some people have them the moment after they get engaged. Some people have them the day after they get engaged, and some people have them under the chuppah. Everything, but everyone has second thoughts. Just a question of when and how often. And you know what? It doesn't end when you get married. And what usually happens is that guys couch it with religious terms. Wait a second. But I went to this mikubel, And he told me that the girl I marry has to have the numerical value of. Wait a second. But maybe she wasn't my Basher. You know, it says in the Gemara. I get this all the time. Once a month I get this. For religious reasons, he's not sure. You know she's not on the religious level. You know what I could do religiously if I had the Mrs. Right? You know how much strength she takes out of me? You know how much learning I could accomplish? You know? Everyone couches it with religiosity. Let me share with you a story. There's a guy who was learning by Rav Chaim of Bris. And serious fellow, but nervous. You know, nervous. All the way down to the chuppah, he was nervous. So he kept saying, Rebbe, is this right? Yeah, yeah, don't worry, it's okay. Rebbe, is this right? Yeah, yeah, okay, comes time to get engaged. So he takes out the ring, and hooray, drops the ring. He says, Rebbe, I told you, you see? So what does Rav Chaim tell him? He says, no, you don't understand. There's an exact moment in heaven when you were supposed to be married. You were jumping the gun by about 10 seconds, so they had to make you drop the ring, not pick it up and get married. Okay? I get this once a month, at least. For religious reasons, suddenly everyone's very pious. Maybe because of A, B, and C, and D. Let's get real. Realistically, every person is going to have second thoughts. This is where it has to be mind over matter. Is it right? Does it make sense? Was there a reason why we got married? Now we're married. Now we have to make it work. Every marriage, in order for it to work, you must approach it with the attitude, I must make it work. There's no marriage that works on autopilot. It doesn't exist. Now, sometimes your parents will do you the disservice of telling you, but our marriage didn't have any problems. I don't know this younger generation. I don't understand them. By us, everything just went smoothly. I knew she was Mrs. Wright. She knew I was Mr. Wright. Everything went smoothly. Listen closely. Don't be fools. Guys, listen between the lines to the stories your parents tell you. I remember there was once a couple that came and said, we don't understand our children. We didn't have any issues. They keep coming and ask this question and that question, and why is this generation so complicated and convoluted? So I said, really, that's fascinating. Could you tell me a little bit about your courtship and this and that? And I start hearing stories, and I'm taking notes as we're talking. And when we finish the conversation, I say, look, I think it'll be very helpful to take everything you said and share it with your children. They said, yeah, but every time we try to share something with our children, they say that we just make things seem perfect. I said, no, I meant what I've written now. They said, what do you mean? I said, let me read it back to you. You guys told me you broke up on your third date because you refused to stop biting your nails in front of her. She said it drives her crazy and you refused. Do you remember that? Yeah, but that wasn't serious. We knew we meant for another. I said, come on, that wasn't... And you guys remember the time that she went to her mother? You told me that in our conversation. She left you, went to her mother for 3 days, and then you called. And then, yeah, but that wasn't serious. I start reading back to them what they said in the course of a two-hour conversation. Very often parents have this flowery view of their own marriage. And then they tell their kids, and their kids who already see a different type of marriage because their parents have been at it for 20, 30 years, come into marriage with this expectation. You know, my parents, they never get... like this with one another. You don't know where they were 30 years ago. Listen closely. Start taking notes. Don't take it the way they give to you at face value. At the same time, those of you who come from homes where your parents are still married, good for you. They've given you a tremendous gift. Most people nowadays come from homes where the parents are not together anymore. And you have to know that that's a challenge to overcome. Something to think about. It's a difficult challenge, which reveals itself in the course of life. When a person has grown up in a home where things got tough, one of the parents said, scram, or both of the parents said, it's over, so then he's walking out of a situation. The mold that he's coming from is a difficult one. He has to find new homes to emulate. And he has to know that within his own marriage, that is a challenge for life. It is a challenge, and it requires true dedication. And when things will come up within the home, and I don't know who I'm talking to in this classroom, because I don't know what home each person comes from, but I know that in this day and age, there were years when we'd go around the class at the very beginning, and I'd ask each person what kind of home they came from, and most years it was over 90% of the guys came from homes where the parents were no longer together. So I know that that's probably the statistic I'm talking to tonight as well. You have to know that we have to do better. And part of doing better is understanding this point that we said tonight. No marriage is perfect, ever. You know what's a perfect marriage? Perfect marriage is a marriage that has its difficulties, and we learn to be happy in spite of the difficulties, and we learn to work things out. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we will discuss that during the course of the year. But part of what we have to train ourselves, and train ourselves I mean in our heads, because our emotions are automatically going to go back to what we've seen at home, which is, if it doesn't work, so it's over. So what we have to train ourselves, at least intellectually, is that in order for marriage to work, there has to be dedication to make it work. Make it work. Every marriage requires that attitude. There's no marriage that can work without that, and that is the first key to making marriage work. Make it work. It's our job to make it work. It does not work on its own, which means it's not easy. It's not easy. That's why we have a class on it. That's why I want someone with a long white beard sitting up here, not me. But at the end of the day, I'm here, so we're going to do the best we can. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to pick up over here next Sunday night. Now we have those minutes.